Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and happy Easter from Catholic Answers Live. I hope you are enjoying the Easter season and the octave of Easter. We Catholics celebrate, we celebrate Sunday of Easter. We celebrate an octave of Easter, which we are in now.
And do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do.
That's an octave.
An octave,
nicely
yeah.
done, yeah.
And it's
also 8 days.
That's an Easter octave.
Oh, yeah. There was an Easter. And we also celebrate an Easter season, which goes on 50 days. Is that right?
Till Pentecost.
Till Pentecost.
Yeah. So we should explain what an octave is, because we have folks who aren't Catholic who listen, and even a lot of Catholics may not know that term. So what's an octave, Cy?
Eight.
Eight. Well, it's clearly eight. Related to the Latin word for eight.
An octave of Easter is 8 days.
Eight days.
So it would be
right.
From this Easter Sunday until the following Sunday would end the octave.
Right.
And that that is now celebrated in the Catholic Church as Divine Mercy Sunday.
In at least the Latin Rite, yeah.
In the Latin Rite of the Catholic Church. That, by the way, is Jimmy Akin, who is our guest this hour. We're going to be discussing the resurrection. In fact, this hour we're going to be discussing defending the resurrection. Not everybody believes in the resurrection. You may be shocked to know. Jimmy is our senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. He's also the author of many things, including A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And you have a whole section in here, a series of days. 10 days out of this are entirely devoted to the resurrection.
I don't know if it's 10, but it's like a week or so of days are devoted to the resurrection. Yeah.
Maybe it's an octave.
We'll have to see.
We'll have to see how we'll count them up as we go.
By the way, you know there's a name for that do re mi stuff. You know what that's called?
No.
Solfeggio.
So why?
I don't recall
the fact that they give a different little sound
to each
tone.
And it was developed by monks in the Middle Ages so they could sing chants.
Oh. Well, those monks, they gave us a lot of good stuff.
They invented clocks too.
Monks invented clocks?
Yeah, because you need to know. Previously they would, because they'd get up in the night to say prayers. They needed to know when to get up. And burning candles wasn't the best way to do that. And so monks invented the water clock, where you'd have water dripping in the clock and it would like fill up a bucket. And eventually that would trip a weight and it'd set an alarm off and they'd know it's time to get up and pray.
Oh. Good for those monks. They gave us a lot of good stuff, including Mystic Monk Coffee. Oh, that's more recent.
That's more recent, though.
Yeah. Jimmy, the resurrection, I suppose if we're going to spend an hour defending the resurrection, it's important, if you don't mind, if we start with what we actually believe about the resurrection. So could you give us the fundamentals of what do Catholics believe about the resurrection of Jesus?
Okay. So and it's not just Catholics, it's all Christians. But ever since the beginning of the Christian church, the resurrection of Jesus has been one of the most central events of the faith. According to the records we have, most in particularly the Gospels, but also other records, Jesus gathered around himself during his earthly ministry a group of disciples, and in particular, he appointed 12 of them to be sort of official leaders mm-hmm. within the broader movement of disciples, and they traveled around with him during his ministry, which we learn lasted for several years, commonly reckoned as 3.5. And then at the end of his ministry, he took a final trip to Jerusalem, like all observant Jews in the Holy Land. He would make regular trips to Jerusalem for the various feasts mm-hmm. that people were obliged to attend in Jerusalem. And one of those was Passover. And so depending on whose chronology you like, either in the year 30 or 33, and I favor the latter date, Jesus took a final trip to Jerusalem, and he did a number of things on that occasion. One of the things he did was he rode into Jerusalem riding on a previously unridden donkey in fulfillment of a messianic prophecy from the Old Testament, and he was thus announcing his role as the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we call today the triumphal entry. He also he went to the temple and again, in fulfillment of messianic prophecy, cleared the temple from people who were buying and selling in areas that were reserved for Gentiles to be praying. And
okay.
they kind of taken them over and made it sort of a religious marketplace when it was really space devoted for Gentiles to pray.
Mm-hmm.
And so he led a kind of temple protest. And people were very struck with him. They were very impressed with him. A lot of people were regarding him as a prophet. And given that he was now holding himself out as a Messiah, and the Messiah was expected to be a revolutionary, and Jesus was leading protests right there in Jerusalem,
yeah.
the Jerusalem authorities became alarmed. And they decided that rather than let a messianic pretender stir up a revolution that was going to cause the Romans to come down on them like a ton of bricks,
right.
they decided it would be better to have Jesus put to death. And so they managed to get one of Jesus's disciples, Judas Iscariot, to betray him. And they arrested him. They tried him before the Jewish leadership council known as the Sanhedrin. But they couldn't put him to death themselves because the Romans had prohibited them from using the death penalty. And so in order to get Jesus put to death, they had to go to the Roman governor, who at the time was Pontius Pilate, and get him to sign off on a death warrant. And so they did this, and Jesus was crucified on the day of Passover, according to the Gospels. And then he lay in, which was a Friday in that year, and then he lay in the tomb until Sunday morning. And on Sunday morning, women came to the tomb to anoint his body and discovered the tomb was empty. And shortly thereafter, and they also saw angels who appeared to them and said, Jesus is raised, just like he told you, but the message hadn't previously been understood. And he's going to start appearing. And he then did start appearing to the disciples and showed that he'd been raised from the dead. He allowed them to physically handle him, to touch him. He ate in their presence to show he wasn't a ghost. And then he continued to instruct them for a period of about 40 days, at which point he ascended into heaven in their sight. So the central claims
okay.
that are relevant here and that have been part of the Christian message from the very beginning are Jesus was crucified and died. He was buried. He rose from the dead. Nobody actually witnessed that, but it's
okay.
an inference because it was in the tomb when it happened. No one else was in the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an inference, but he rose from the dead. And how we know that is the tomb was empty. He appeared to people alive. And finally, he ascended into heaven. And so that complex of events forms the core of the Christian gospel regarding Jesus's death on our behalf, which then provides salvation for us, which is something that I understand you and Tim Staples are going to be talking about in the next hour.
And the second hour will be about why the resurrection matters.
Yeah.
Indeed. So now that has a great deal to do with our salvation.
Mm-hmm.
We're just before we go to a break, we're were there immediate objections to this idea, to Christ, this idea that Jesus had been raised from the dead, or do those come later?
Well, actually, depending on how you want to look at it, yeah, they were right there. In fact, among the disciples themselves,
mm-hmm.
because even though Jesus had said previously that he was going to rise from the dead, they thought he was like speaking allegorically or something.
Yeah.
And so the Gospels mentioned that like when this is after the Transfiguration, when they're coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus tells them he's going to die and then rise from the dead. And it says, we're told they didn't understand what he meant, and they asked themselves about what does that mean?
Yeah.
So they thought it was some kind of allegory. So actually, when the tomb is discovered empty, they don't instantly think, oh, he's been raised. the first thing that they think, the first theory to explain the empty tomb is somebody moved his body.
Yeah.
That's what Mary Magdalene says when she gets back from the tomb, is like someone's taken him, taken the body. And then when they first see Jesus mm-hmm. after the resurrection, they're still not thinking he's been raised from the dead, because ordinary first century Jews expected the resurrection to happen at the end of time.
Right.
And okay. so they didn't expect it to happen in their own day. And so they, when they first see Jesus, their first theory is it's his ghost, that this is his spirit yeah. appearing to us. And that's why he invites them to touch him
yeah.
so that they can feel that he has a body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why he eats in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so to show them, look, I'm really back from the dead. So actually, among the disciples themselves, there were two alternate theories to the resurrection that had to be knocked down, that somebody just moved the body
yep.
and then that they saw him kind of spiritually as a ghost or something.
Fair enough. Okay, we will tackle more objections to the resurrection as we defend the resurrection, now that we've got a clear understanding of what it is that Christians believe that happened to Jesus on the Sunday following his Friday death. We'll be right back with more of that on Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
50 years ago, Blessed Pope Paul VI released his encyclical Humanae Vitae, reaffirming the Catholic Church's condemnation of contraception. Catholic Answers magazine is marking the anniversary with a very special issue delving deep into what is arguably one of the Church's most controversial documents in modern times. Want to be sure to get your copy? Subscribe right now to the best Catholic apologetics magazine anywhere by calling 818-487-2011 or by going to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. Don't miss out on what will be a virtual handbook on the most important aspects of Paul VI's profound and prophetic document. Don't wait another moment to subscribe. Call 818-487-2011 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to get subscriptions for yourself and those you love. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine from Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Happy Easter and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest this hour is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And we're discussing the resurrection, particularly defending the resurrection against those who would, in one way or another, provide alternate theories to what happened.
To Jesus.
Yeah. And we're taking I'm taking my clue from A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, Jimmy's book, in which you have on each day a different objection to the Christian faith and an explanation or a defense of the traditional Christian belief.
Mm-hmm.
On day 206, you start with the real probably the most basic objection to the resurrection of Jesus. There's no good evidence that Jesus actually rose from the dead.
Well, actually, there is. There are a limited number of options to explain the claims that Christians were making. One option is the claims are true. that Jesus rose from the dead, he ascended into heaven, he died, all that stuff happened. That's one explanation. But if you want to say, well, maybe something else happened, then you need to provide an account of what that could have been. And there are a number of options. Maybe they made a bunch of stuff up. You know, maybe they were a bunch of crooks and liars.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's one possibility. Most people don't want to go that far, and we can talk about why. But if they weren't lying, well, then what could have explained these claims that they made? And some people have said, well, maybe the reason they found Jesus's tomb empty was because they went to the wrong tomb.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a different tomb, and nobody was buried in that one.
That would be like the biggest mistake in history.
It would be a pretty big mistake.
Like 2,000 years of Christianity based on that.
Then there will be other explanations, and we'll cover the problems with these explanations, but additional alternate theories include things like, well, maybe he didn't die on the cross. Maybe he just passed out or swooned.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it wasn't him on the cross. Mm-hmm. Maybe he had an identical twin and it was the twin that got crucified. You know, and so there are a variety of different alternatives. But what happens when you look at the alternatives is it's very easy to knock each one of them down.
Yeah. And
there's good evidence against each of the alternatives. And that means, as Sherlock Holmes tells us, whenever you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can show that there are good reasons to say, well, these alternative theories don't work, then that provides you with good evidence that they are in fact true. So I would say there is evidence, and the evidence for the central Christian claims consists in the fact that if you consider the alternatives are just don't work.
Fair enough. Okay. So let's actually go through them then, because in the following days, like say on day 207, you actually address the wrong tomb hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
which would be just the greatest. It's like a Keystone Cops explanation. Like, whoops, we accidentally invented a religion. Why can't we explain the resurrection by saying that the disciples simply went to the wrong tomb, a tomb that was empty?
Well, there are several problems. First of all, it's very unlikely that they would go to the wrong tomb, because according to the Gospels, Jesus was buried in basically the same location that the crucifixion happened. That the crucifixion happened in a garden at a place called Golgotha, which is Aramaic for the skull,
mm-hmm.
and so it was a kind of an outcropping that looked like a skull, and so it was a readily identifiable landmark, and then he was buried in a tomb that was right there in that same garden. And this had been witnessed by many people, including the same women who then went back to the tomb. So they had been there at the crucifixion.
I see.
If you read the Gospels, it even names the women. It tells us who they were, that they were there at the crucifixion, and then they came back to the same spot to anoint Jesus's body in the tomb. And they saw the burial also. The Gospels tell us. So what the Gospel authors are doing with the women is showing us the chain of custody,
mm-hmm.
in other words, or the provenance of this information. They saw the crucifixion. They saw him die. They saw him get buried, and they came back to the same spot and found the tomb empty. Also, the tomb was owned by a disciple of Jesus named Joseph of Arimathea. It was his family tomb. And so he obviously knew where his family tomb was.
Right.
And if people had gone to the wrong tomb, Joseph of Arimathea would have said, wait a minute, guys, he's buried right here in my family tomb right here.
Yeah.
So he would have corrected that misimpression. Also, the Jewish authorities would have just gone to the tomb, and produced the body as well. If need be, they would have searched multiple tombs to produce the body because they didn't want Christians preaching this message. So simply an innocent go to the wrong tomb is going to be very implausible on its face. But then look at what it doesn't explain. It doesn't explain how Jesus appeared to them.
Yeah.
You know, just because you go to a wrong tomb, it doesn't mean that someone can appear to you after they've died.
Right.
It doesn't mean you can fly up into heaven.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So it's just the wrong – just going to the wrong tomb is not going to explain the claims effectively.
Okay, so what about the – so let's move on then. The next hypothesis, or the alternate theory, I guess we could call it, is what you call in the book the trick hypothesis. Why can't we explain the resurrection by saying someone tricked the disciples? Maybe Jesus was drugged on the cross when he was given a drink. Later he revived and co-conspirators got him out of the tomb and posed as angels. Wow.
Okay, so this one seeks to explain how the disciples could innocently think all this, you know, that he had been raised and so forth. Mm-hmm. There are a number of problems. First of all, the drug hypothesis is antecedently improbable because anesthesia was not a developed science at this time. And if you're giving somebody a drug to knock them out, first of all, why would they even do that? I mean, why would Jesus have conspirators who would do this?
Yeah.
But even supposing someone tried, you stand a very good chance of killing the person, especially if they had been subjected to all of the brutality that Jesus was leading up to this. Then, even if Jesus had survived that, he wouldn't have survived what happened next while he was on the cross, because in order to confirm his death, mm-hmm. a Roman centurion pierced his side with a lance, mm-hmm. and blood and water flowed out, is what the Gospels say. Now, that's phenomenological language. When it says water, it wouldn't have been actual water. It was a clear bodily fluid. Mm-hmm. So a mixture of blood and clear bodily fluid came out. Now, doctors have looked into this and said, well, what medical phenomena would explain that? And basically, there are a couple of options. When a person is suffering from trauma like heart failure, which could have been brought on by all the rigors he had suffered before and during the crucifixion. But when a person is suffering from heart failure and conditions like that, a clear fluid will build up either in the pleural cavity of your lungs, mm-hmm. or in the pericardial sac around the heart. And so when the soldier pierced Jesus's side, he apparently either pierced the pleural cavity of the lung or the pericardial sac of the heart, and this liquid flowed out. Well, okay, no antibiotics in this age. That was a fatal wound right there. I mean, that's the reason they're sure that he's doing this is to confirm his death. And in case he wasn't, there's no doubt after you do this to him. Yeah. So he wouldn't have survived that, even if he had been knocked out by some drug. Then we have, as we continue along with what the disciples reported, I mean, there's a bunch of implausibilities, like how did he get out of a guarded tomb and things like that. But just to jump to kind of the coup de grace for this, being drugged and having co-conspirators get you out of a tomb does not enable you to fly. So important it wouldn't note. Explain the ascension.
Yeah, right. Okay. It also really presents a very devious Jesus.
It does, and that's inconsistent with other things. But, you know, people have proposed it as an alternative, and it, like the other alternatives, doesn't fit the evidence we have.
What about that maybe he just fainted then? Because that's the next one, the swoon hypothesis. Why can't we explain it just by saying he just passed out?
Yeah, that's vulnerable to a lot of the same objections. It's something that wouldn't – even if he had just passed out on the cross – you know, naturally, as opposed to a drug, he's still not going to survive the side wound from
a
spear.
Yeah.
And he's very unlikely to get out of the tomb on his own. I mean, how does a weakened man who's just been crucified get out of a tomb without any help? Because there's a big stone there. You know, how does he get around that? And then still, you can't fly.
But also, isn't it true that like part of the idea of resurrection is if you faint, if you swoon, you do die because you'll suffocate. You won't be able to.
So that's more ambiguous.
Oh, okay.
There have been some people who have proposed that part of the reason you die when you're crucified is because it prevents you from effectively – it puts such stress on your chest that you can't effectively inhale, and so you end up suffocating and you have to – to avoid that, you have to keep pushing yourself up in order to take the pressure off your chest so you can inhale and exhale properly. And then if you passed out, you obviously wouldn't be lifting yourself up again and you'd suffocate.
Yeah.
That's the idea. The problem is more recent studies of crucifixion don't support that. That we've had people who we haven't actually crucified them, but we've had like volunteers who've been tied to a cross to see what effect does it effects does it have on your muscles, and actually their backs just naturally arch out and they're able to breathe for that reason.
I see. Okay, Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. We are defending the resurrection. I'm from. Various theories and hypotheses that are proposed as alternate explanations. Among them, we have already covered that they went to the wrong tomb, that Jesus had some co-conspirators and they just tricked the apostles and disciples, and that Jesus just fainted on the cross. He didn't really die. There's more to come, though, more alternate explanations, some a little more convincing than these, and we'll take a look at those and the response. How do we defend the resurrection with Jimmy Akin? More of that coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop J. Michael Miller of Vancouver, Canada, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I come from the other side of the tracks, see? My uncle used to have slot machines. Put one nickel in and it's emptied. Boom. And I brought him home in a bag, and my mother looked at me. Where did you get all that money? I said, I won him. You didn't win him. He fixed the machine. I didn't care if he fixed the machine or not, you know?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our fifth annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there.
We've had a wonderful time going home all enthused.
Every time we come here, it's just an incredible experience.
Normally, you'd have to root through a dozen different books to get half the stuff I've learned here.
These guys are so amazing. I always get so much, learn so much. I've already signed up for next year.
Join us this September 27th to the 30th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. All of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and special keynote speaker, Raymond Leo Cardinal Burke.
I enjoy the atmosphere and the friendliness of the people. I'm having a great time.
I love it. I love it. I'm so glad I came here.
I've just learned so much. You know, I've been a Catholic all my life. It's just been so wonderful.
I love it. I want to come back every year.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Happy Easter again, and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about the resurrection today. Next hour, Tim Staples will be here, and we'll talk about why the resurrection matters, connect what happened with Jesus in the tomb to what happens with us today here on Earth, and also what happens as a consequence to human history. This hour, however, we're defending the resurrection against common objections and some less common objections that are made to the claim that Christians make that Christ rose from the dead. We've tackled a few. We now go on to this one I find very, very interesting, and this is on day 212 of your – oh, no, excuse me. I'm on the wrong one. Well, now I've lost my day. But anyways, it's in the early 200s.
Become unstuck in time, like Billy Pilgrim.
A daily defense, 365 days to becoming a better apologist. Oh, here it is. Okay, it's on day 210. It's the twin hypothesis.
Okay.
Why can't we explain the resurrection appearance by saying Jesus had a twin who was crucified, making the disciples innocently think Jesus was raised?
Okay, so let's start with the antecedent probability of this. It's going to be low. Identical. So in order for a twin to pass as Jesus, the twin would need to be an identical twin. A fraternal twin, wouldn't would do, because fraternal twins look different. They can even be the opposite sex.
Yeah.
So you need, what you need is an identical twin. And the chance of a person even having an identical twin is very low. In humans, it's about 3 in 1,000 people as an identical twin. So it's 0.3% chance that Jesus would have even had an identical twin. But suppose he did. Well, that's a notable fact. You know, I mean, you have Jesus get born, and then in, you know, within a few minutes earlier or later, another person gets born.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a notable thing. And we have records of Jesus's birth and childhood. Mm-hmm. If there had been a twin, it would have been mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it would have been part of, you know, the Christian message from the beginning. God had these, this pair of holy twins that came down, you know, and so it also would have been known by Jesus's family members and by the disciples that Jesus had this twin, because, you know, people take note of these things. And so
So many of these people who are following Jesus are from the same neighborhood, the same, even the same town.
So suppose the twin's name is Bob.
Yeah.
Okay. So
Bob of Nazareth.
Bob of Nazareth. And so the disciples have been following Jesus around, and they know about Bob, and then they see Jesus get crucified, and then someone who looks just like Jesus shows up.
Yeah.
They're going to think, hi, Bob.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to mistake the twin for Jesus. It's immediately going to occur to them that this is the twin.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a bunch of problems there, but there's some more problems. So this doesn't do anything to explain the empty tomb.
Oh, that's
even
a good point,
even
yeah.
if you said there was a twin and the disciples somehow mistook the twin for Jesus, well, okay, why didn't the Jewish authorities or Joseph of Arimathea, when he later wanted to bury someone else in his own family tomb, why didn't they just produce the body of Jesus? And it's like, here it is, guys. That's just Bob.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Furthermore, there'd have to be some really unusual abilities in this family, because most twins can't fly.
Okay.
And so once again, we've got the problem of the hypothesis does not explain the complete Christian message, including the ascension of Jesus.
To heaven. Right. And I'm thinking too that the part about them touching the wounds of Jesus. I mean, I guess you could fake that.
And so I didn't mention that one because you could fake it. And either Jesus or Bob would have to be deliberately lying.
Yeah.
Because whichever one of them did the resurrection appearances would know, I'm not the one who was crucified.
Right.
So there would have to be deception on the part of either Jesus or Bob.
Mm-hmm. I think he went by Robert. If he had existed, he'd have gone by Robert. No, Robert didn't.
Things were pretty
casual.
Pretty. I mean, Aramaic was a kind of, you know, rural place. He might have gone by Bobby.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So no twin. Jesus did not have a twin. But what about this? Because I actually think this is one that people might accept more easily than some of the other objections. On day 211 of A Daily Defense, you give us the imposter hypothesis. The gospel says the disciples had difficulty recognizing Jesus after the resurrection, and they did. You give a whole bunch of citations. So maybe he was actually replaced by an imposter.
Okay. There are a number of issues here. First of all, the passages that that can be produced about them having difficulty recognizing him, with one exception, they're basically explainable by distance. Because, like, one of them, for example, is at the Sea of Galilee. The disciples are fishing, and Jesus is on the shore, and he calls out to them. And at first, they don't recognize him. And then he tells them, cast your nets on the other side of the boat and you're going to get a bunch of fish, mm-hmm. which is a replication of something he did at the very beginning of his ministry. And at that point, the beloved disciple recognizes him and says, it's the Lord. And mm-hmm. so this is a case of they don't recognize him
because
he's way far away.
Yeah.
They can probably barely hear him. He's off on the shore. I mean, the Sea of Galilee is miles and miles wide. They were obviously close enough they could kind of see him and kind of hear him, but it's not distinct. It's just distance. Same thing with Mary Magdalene. when Mary Magdalene's at the tomb, she initially, she's there, she's in the garden. Peter and John have come and seen the empty tomb, and then they go back home, and she's there weeping at the tomb, and Jesus appears to her, and she initially thinks that it's like the gardener or something who's caring there to care for the garden. She doesn't recognize him, but then it says, but then he says her name, and then it says she turns and recognizing him and recognizes him. So apparently she wasn't looking in his direction. She's there, she's weeping, she's aware of somebody behind her, but she doesn't even look at the guy until he says Mary, and then she looks and realizes it's Jesus. So it's a perfectly normal explanation for that. The only example where there seems to be something more to it than just distance or not looking in his direction is what happens on the road to Emmaus. Well, I should say this is the only one in the canonical Gospels.
Oh.
There's kind of a fun thing that happens, though, in an apocryphal work from the late second century called the Acts of John.
Okay.
The Acts of John is, as the name would suggest, it's an apocryphal book of Acts describing what John did later in his career. And this is all legend. This is not historically reliable. But there's a fascinating bit where in the Acts of John, John is depicted as reporting an encounter that he and his brother James had with Jesus, and they were seeing Jesus differently. So it's kind of like that episode of Star Trek with the salt vampire. Is that the man trap? Where the different officers on the Enterprise see this beautiful woman, but they're each seeing a different beautiful woman. And that's what's happening in the Acts of John with James and John. John sees Jesus as a bald man with a thick flowing beard.
Okay.
And James sees him as a young man whose beard is just starting to grow.
Oh.
And they're talking to him at the same time, and they don't realize this until later.
Oh.
So
that is a clever little bit.
But what that's based on, that kind of thing seems to be based on, is something that actually is in the canonical Gospels.
Okay.
Because if you read Luke 24, one of the accounts that Luke relates is an encounter where Jesus appeared to two disciples. One of them was a relative of Jesus named Clopas and a companion of his, who were walking from Jerusalem to a nearby town called Emmaus. And so they're on the road to Emmaus. They meet Jesus, and we're told that their eyes were kept from recognizing him. So this could be a couple of things. It could be he's appearing in a different form. You know, and if you're God, you can do that. It could also be, and I kind of am intrigued by this theory, it could also be induced prosopagnosia.
That's what I always think.
Yeah.
So what is that?
Prosopagnosia is a known medical condition where something in the brain is unable to connect faces with identities.
Okay.
And so So people who have prosopagnosia, it's also known as face blindness. People with prosopagnosia can actually see perfectly fine, but for some reason, there's something going on in their brain where they, even though they can see your face, they can't recognize you. And so people with prosopagnosia have to use clues even for their loved ones. Like, okay, what kind of hat is this person wearing? Do I recognize that hat? Or what kind of shirt are they wearing? Do I recognize that shirt? Or can I get them to talk to me? Maybe I can recognize their voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible. I'm not saying it is the case, but it's possible. You know, God could have just stopped the face recognition process
for them.
But it's temporary because then when they get to Emmaus, they invite Jesus without realizing he's Jesus. They invite him to eat with them. And as they're eating, suddenly they recognize Jesus. And so either he changes form back into his normal form, or the induced prosopagnosia stops and suddenly their brains click the clues into place and they realize, oh, this is him.
Yeah.
I know this guy. And then he disappears. So we have Jesus playfully shielding his identity from these people miraculously. But this is the only case where that happens. Now, it doesn't. So there's and there's no possibility of an imposter here because they then do recognize him. And most imposters can't vanish. Furthermore, even if there was somebody impersonating Jesus, where how do we explain the empty tomb? It's not a sufficient hypothesis. Doesn't explain the ascension because imposters don't have anti-gravity belts. They can't ascend into heaven.
Right. Yeah.
Not in the first century anyway. Maybe the 31st.
One can only hope.
Yeah.
For the coming anti-gravity belts.
Or the flight rings that replace them.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. In the Legion of Superheroes.
Oh, okay. Prosopagnosia.
Prosopagnosia. Yeah. Prosopon is the Greek word for face.
Oh.
Ah means not, and gnosis means knowledge.
Yeah.
So not knowing faces. Prosopagnosia.
All right. We got more of these, and the one that I think is most persistent, we have still yet gotten to. The most persistent modern objection is the objection that this is all hallucination. And so that and others, when we come back from this break, as we defend the resurrection with Jimmy Akin, our guest on Catholic Answers Live, we'll be right back.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. Sayings like these are such a part of tradition that we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers, even though nobody can seem to place their origin. By sheer repetition, they have acquired a halo of truth. In What the Saints Never Said, Trent Horn takes over 40 of these well-known but actual dubious sayings and attempts to track them to their true source. The result? He finds some that are close to what was really said, many that were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few that were just plain made up. By setting the record straight, Trent roots out theological errors that can lead us away from Christian truth and offers authentic quotes from Scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to that truth. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said today by calling 1-888-291-8. Visiting the shop at Catholic.com or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Over the years, we have heard thousands of stories of how the ministry of Catholic Answers and Catholic Answers Live has changed lives all over the world. Do you have such a story? We'd love to hear how Catholic Answers has changed your life. Send your story to us today. Email us at mystory@catholic.com or you can call 619-387-7200 to make an audio recording of your story.
Are faith and science compatible? Join us this September 27th to the 30th as we tackle the topic at Catholic Answers' 5th National Apologetics Conference. We've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith, including our very special keynote speaker, Raymond Leo Cardinal Burke. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Happy Easter. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are discussing objections to the resurrection and defending the truth of the resurrection as Christians understand it with Jimmy Akin, the author of A Daily Defense. And we're looking at, in the midst of A Daily Defense, in the early 200s, day 206, 207 there, you can find these various objections to the resurrection or various alternate theories. We're now on the hallucination hypothesis. That's on day 212. And the challenge, Jimmy, is why can't we explain the resurrection appearance of Jesus by saying that the disciples innocently hallucinated them all?
There are several problems here. The first one is some of them are group encounters.
Yeah.
Many of them are group encounters, like the one we just mentioned with the Emmaus Road encounter. You had two guys that conduct an extensive conversation with Jesus. Well, okay, there's a question about can hallucinations even happen? with groups?
Yeah.
Or are they something that's – I'm not talking about can people misidentify something as a group.
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine a group of people. They see something in the distance.
Yeah.
They think it's something. It's not. You know, maybe they see a bear and they think it's Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So you can have
– or the reverse.
Or they could see Bigfoot and think it's a bear.
Right.
Absolutely. So you can have group misidentifications.
Sure.
But
okay.
A group hallucination where your brain is making something up out of nothing – there's a debate about can that even happen with a group of people.
No.
But even if it can, you're not going to hallucinate the same conversation.
Right.
You know, you're not going to do that. And so there are problems proposing hallucination as an explanation for these group encounters. Especially because they involve, you know, people engaging in a multi-party conversation where they're hearing the same thing. They may be touching Jesus, you know, because he invites them to do that to prove he's physical, which is, again, a strike against the hallucination idea because hallucinations, you know, you wouldn't feel them. They're just something you see.
Yeah.
But there are other fundamental problems. Doesn't explain the empty tomb.
No. Right.
Because the body would still be in the tomb,
yep.
And people could still go there and produce it and would have because there seems to have been universal agreement that the body was no longer there. Matthew, in his gospel, records that the rumor in his day in Jewish circles was that the disciples had stolen the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that – Matthew wouldn't bother responding to that unless it was a real charge. I mean, he's not going to create an embarrassing situation for himself where he makes up a charge that wasn't in circulation. So the charge that was in circulation was that the disciples stole the body, and that would indicate that the Jewish authorities
couldn't find it. Yeah.
And so that would indicate that there was – that the body genuinely was not there. And the hallucination hypothesis doesn't do anything to explain that.
Yeah. I think that thing you said too about it, well, like, how would multiple people have the same hallucination of an extended conversation or something?
Also, we don't find the disciples in an appropriate state psychologically for hallucinations.
Yeah.
One of the things that, you know, you could kind of imagine, let's say they had this fervent hope that Jesus is going to rise from the dead. And then they could maybe kind of talk themselves into they saw Jesus in the distance.
Yeah.
Maybe and they misidentified somebody else.
Yeah, right.
Well, okay. The problem is that still is not going to explain the up close and personal encounters.
Yes.
But also they're not in that frame of mind. They're despairing.
Right.
The male disciples have given up, and the female disciples are going to the tomb so they can anoint his dead body.
Yeah.
They're expecting him to be dead. Then when they find he's not there, the first thing they think is the body's been moved. And then even when they see him, their first thought is, this is a ghost.
Yeah. Right.
So because they're not expecting the resurrection until the end of time.
Right.
And so they're not expecting the resurrection right now. There's no attitude of expectancy that could gin up hallucinations.
Fair enough. I got to move just because I want to make sure I get to all of them.
Yeah.
The spiritual resurrection hypothesis. Why can't we just explain the resurrection as a purely spiritual event or in purely spiritual terms?
N.T. Wright is a British biblical scholar. He has a whole book that is largely devoted to this. But basically, he points out that's not what Jews were expecting. They understood the difference between a person who was just spiritually alive after their death, you know, a ghost, and a resurrected person. And the Gospels go out of their way to show us this is not a ghost.
Yeah.
Jesus eats fish in the presence of the disciples. He tells them, handle me, for a spirit has not flesh and bones, as you can see that I do.
Right.
And so the Gospels go out of their way to show us this isn't some form of spiritual life after death. Jesus really has been bodily raised.
It almost gives you the sense that they anticipate or are experiencing that spiritual. Oh, you saw a ghost. He was really raised.
Yeah,
yeah. Right. One that kind of puts the disciples in a bad light. The disciples stole Jesus' body and then lied about the resurrection.
Yeah, so there are a number of problems with this, but it really does come down to, I mean, because this would explain the objective facts, you know, that there's no body because they stole it,
uh-huh.
and then they lied about the resurrection appearances and the ascension. So mm-hmm. it would cover those facts in a way that none of the previous theories have.
Uh-huh.
Problem is, it doesn't fit the character of the apostles because you read the literature of the New Testament. These guys believe what they're talking about. You know, mm-hmm. even skeptical scholars don't, in reading the New Testament, they acknowledge the sincerity mm-hmm. of these authors, that they really believe what they're saying here. And they believe it so much that they're willing to undertake lots of hardship
yeah.
to proclaim this message. If you read the book of Acts, just Acts alone, I mean, they're facing all kinds of dangers. I mean, they get repeatedly arrested and beaten and thrown in prison. And one of them even gets martyred just in the book of Acts. And yeah. we know from other sources that others got martyred, including St. Peter, St. Paul. Sometimes you'll hear this claim that all of them except John died martyrs' deaths. We really don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
The that's saying too much. And in fact, there's some evidence John may have died a martyr's death too. But we know that death and torture and imprisonment were real dangers to these guys that
yeah.
that many of them did suffer. And why would they do that? I mean, what's the motive to make up this resurrection story and keep preaching it when you've been told not to?
Yeah.
Why would you do this if you weren't sincere?
Yeah.
And we have no records anywhere of any of them faltering in their testimony, and you can be sure that the enemies of Christianity would have
even one of them had
said, you know, we made it up. That would have been trumpeted.
Right.
And yeah. and so we don't have any record of that. All they would have had to do to stop the persecution that they were experiencing is just shut up.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And go somewhere else where nobody knew them.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we don't have records of anything like that. They were willing to undertake extreme personal hardship and even face death for the sake of their witness to Jesus. And that's why the Greek word for witness, martyr, has become, or the English version of it is martyr, has become a synonym for a person who dies for their faith.
Yeah.
Because their witness to Jesus was so solid that they were willing to die for it.
Yeah.
And so consequently, the claim that they were just a bunch of liars, it just doesn't bear scrutiny. That's not credible.
It would be a big bunch of liars too, wouldn't it?
A bunch of liars,
because there's hundreds of people who had the claim that they saw Jesus.
That is the case, yeah. Now, I can imagine scenarios to try to get around that verse in 1 Corinthians where Paul mentions that there were hundreds. But just if we look at the core disciples, I mean, there's like 12 of them there who all would have had to be co-conspirators on this because they all claim to be witnesses to the risen Christ.
Okay, so the last of the hypotheses, thank you, is the combined hypothesis, or you combine various hypotheses. Why can't we explain the resurrection by combining some of these, such as proposing that the disciples went to the wrong tomb and then hallucinated?
Yeah, well, we've actually kind of considered some combined hypotheses. Like the previous one involved somebody, namely the disciples, stole the body to explain the empty tomb, and they then lied about the resurrection appearances and the ascension. So that's kind of a combined hypothesis. The problem is when you start combining these, it may explain some things, but the combined hypotheses also inherit problems. yeah, from the previous ones. Yeah. So, like, what was the example you gave of a combined hypothesis?
They went to the wrong tomb and then they hallucinated.
Okay. Well, that obviously wouldn't explain the empty tomb if they just went to the wrong tomb.
Yeah.
That would have been, there are actually bunches of problems it inherits, but one of the problems it inherits is that his body would still be in the tomb and it would have been produced even if they went to an empty one and then hallucinated.
Jimmy Akin, he is the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. You can find each of the objections we went over and a full page refutation of those objections in that book. I highly recommend that you get it. Jimmy, thanks so much for a fascinating hour.
Thank you. I'm just glad that Jesus died and rose from the dead so we could all go to the good place.
Amen to that. Jesus is risen. Next hour, Tim Staples will be here. We'll talk about why that matters right after this on Catholic Answers Live.